would you be interested in switching your internet service providings to a provider that provides better service of internet service providings than your current provider?
I've worked in the street. Radio stars are alive and well here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Thanks for listening.
Hey, Black, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Stéphane Doucette, always here with my co-host,
Mustafa Hedaway.
You can hear us every third Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca online, and also you can find our archive there and on our Mixcloud page. You can find us on Facebook as well, search Labor Radio to find the link there. And you'll just be able to find all of our previous episodes and so on. We're also available on the Labor Radio Podcast Network, where you can find other labor-related podcasts around the world. Great show today. Our friend Dave Pritchett out from BC to come talk to us about the longshoremen strike this summer.
Oh, and to talk about automation, to talk about... you know, really just the history of the Longshore Workers Union out in BC and a lot of the fights around job displacement as a result of automation. So it's not really just about the longshore and the ports, but it's one of those interviews that really, I think, sets the stage for like what's happening across labor right now in terms of technological change and the world of work itself.
Yeah, and I think, anyways, you'll all get a chance to hear it shortly, but pretty nice to hear someone with that level of experience sort of pick apart the sort of the boss's arguments and the capitalist's arguments. It's pretty satisfying, I'm not gonna lie. Just lays it out straight. So great to have him on. Stick around for that. We don't have a ton of time to talk about other labor news, but we will probably be talking to someone from the Metro strike shortly. So look on our Facebook for that. It might be published in our show next month. It might just be online. We'll see.
And also one of the things that we're planning to talk about in the coming months more often is Saturday there'll be a major demonstration for the Common Front around pu the public sector negotiations that's taking place at 1 p.m. At Jean Mons Park. And it's really going to set the stage for how the negotiations begin to really unfold and how the struggle of the Common Front will unfold. So Saturday is going to be a really important demonstration in terms of for the public sector negotiations.
Yeah, and so since everyone is invited to that to show their support, I think it's really important for those of us who are able to be there, because this is our whole healthcare system, which is, I mean, in shambles. I don't know how else to describe it. It's pathetic. So education as well, those are the big sort of sectors. And we need the most public pressure to show support for the union movement on this one. Make sure that it stays united and stays on big questions that are important to regular people in the province.
Yeah, and it's because it's not just about wages, it's really also about actually expanding public service and protecting our basic public services, which they're constantly gutting at this point.
Yeah, it's a very political labor struggle, so very important to be there. So I hope that all the listeners to today's shows can show up on Saturday here in Montreal. And there's also demonstrations all across the province and other cities and towns. So wishing them all the best, and we'll be seeing some of you there on Saturday. And maybe on that note, we should just get to our interview with Dave.
Yeah, you're listening to Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM.
Thank you.
So welcome back to Labor Radio. We are so happy to have with us Dave Pritchett. He's a retired longshoreman with the ILW out in Vancouver. I'll let him describe sort of why we want to be talking with him. But the reason why in general is because of the recent ILW strikes earlier this summer. So we're going to be talking a bit about that and just about the union in general and dock workers in general. Dave, thanks so much for coming on.
Nice to see you.
And maybe can you start just by explaining to us, like, sort of what's your background with ILW and labor in general?
Sure. Well, it goes back a long ways because my grandfather was the founding president of IWA, and that organizing drive, my dad got engaged with that. And so he ended up being the founding president of ILW Canadian Area, which when they got autonomy from ILW International in San Francisco back in 59, it became the Canadian Area, now called ILW Canada. I worked on the docks from 18 to 64. So I was down there when the last of the Second World War Liberty ships were coming into port. Small lift trucks, slings, cargo nets, bringing cargo back and forth. Well, those docks have grown exponentially. I mean, it was only the 1800s that sailing ships were pulling into Port Moody out here, taking big timbers over to Japan. And now we've come a long way with containerization. And that leads up to this strike because it's about more automation. And it also leads up to the strike because the promises of negotiations back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with the modernization of the docks, yes, it would speed up cargo. Yes, it would take away jobs because of mechanization, but there was promises by the employer to upgrade all our training so we would be doing the maintenance on the new machinery. But as we know, in the last couple of years now, we're facing robots and we're facing artificial intelligence, and the employer is only too ready to lay everybody off and not carry out those historical promises.
So we're going to touch on a lot of these different things. I wanted to start maybe by explaining, first of all, that obviously the ILW strike was very big. It's probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, labor story of the year in Canada, notwithstanding the PSAC strike as well. But anyways, huge economic impact, huge pressure brought to bear on the workers and the union. But one thing that we noticed was that as soon as the strike was over and the agreement was signed, you didn't hear anybody saying anything about the agreement, whether the employer or the union. So there can be all kinds of reasons why people don't want to speak to it. And, you know, obviously out of respect, you're retired, you might not want to get into it, but can you explain maybe why people might not want to speak on it or anything like that?
Well, I was thinking about that very question today because we'd had earlier conversations around this point. And I've been through two divorces in my life. And when I make up those agreements, it's between me and my ex and the lawyer, but I don't broadcast it to my neighborhood. And if you think about a union contract, it is an honorarium between the employer group and the union group. So there is no historical precedent, really, for a union to stand up at the end of these intense negotiations with the whole country looking at them and say, well, here's what we got out of the deal. And also, too, you know as well as I do, is that the media will cut snippets out of said conversations and play that card. For instance, longshoremen are all making 130 grand a year. I'll tell you straight up, that's bullshit. If people are making that kind of money, you're a family man, I'm a family man, that means you're working 7 days a week, sometimes 3 weeks in a row, sometimes double shifting, sometimes working through the night and short shifting. There's nothing free. And I spent 44 years down there, and some of my good friends are dead because of alcoholism, because of fatigue and getting in the bite and dying. So this concept of longshoremen are all sitting back making big money is bullshit. And this is the first strike, I think. And I went to ILW Canada website today, and Rob Ashton, the president of the union, reminds everybody, this is the first strike we've had in 30 years. And the government comes across, and some of these international shippers who abuse the working class on those deep sea ships and pay them peanuts and try and de-unionize them, which they've been doing down in Australia on and off for years. And they try and make us out as the bad guys. But the profits they're making, they don't divulge that. And then here's another thing. We're all suffering inflation. Inflation, if I own a store or a company or the gas pump, I can randomly put my prices up. Longshore got over an 8-year agreement. Now we've signed up for a 4-year agreement down in the States. I read in the Dispatcher today out of Frisco, they're signing up, waiting for ratification from the ranks for a 6-year. Now that is a promise. I cannot up my wages if I'm working for a 4 or 6 year period, but we're suffering these employers lecturing us about inflation, and they can randomly put stuff up 10 and 20%. They don't have a meeting. They just do it. If I said, oh, I can't afford a cost of living, I'm upping my wages, you know, today, they'll say, bullshit, you signed a collective agreement, you have to stick to this. So, you know, it's not a level playing field. But the big thing that was going on in this strike, you've got multiple platforms of media. I'm not an expert at it, but you've got hundreds of thousands of people, some people spending too much time in their basement, giving political opinion to outrageously reactive right-wing groups, ragging on longshoremen, ragging on the working class. So I could see, if I was a union leader, I'm not going to trot to the microphone before the ink is dry and come out and say, here's what we got. And then they rip us to hell for the next 4 years because they don't want to organize. They don't support unions. And they're going to wait for the trickle down theory. Ronald Reagan, you know, trickled down on everybody. We haven't recovered. And Margaret Thatcher broke unions over there. And the forces we're up against here are basically, even though we got agreements in the labor code, they will not do anything really to support the needs of the working class in Canada. So we keep our cards as close to our economic chest, you might say, as we can. And the employer also knows that they're playing the ass in a lot of these negotiations, and they know what the price of freight is. And I'll tell you, the money that was made when the Panama Canal went down, container freight rates went from, say, $8,000-$10,000 a container up to $18,000 and $20,000 because they had to go around the horn. Now, did the longshoremen benefit from any of that? No, you'd think we were bandits trying to steal the system. So I'm vexed about it, but we're also up against a dynamic that I could say this, your radio broadcast, 2,000 people, but who will hear the actual overview of what's really going on for the condition of working people here? And I'd suggest that longshoremen are paying way more taxes than the millionaires they're meeting with who are hiding their profits in the Bahamas. It's a stacked deck, and usually we stack lumber and logs on deck, but a lot of these arguments we're getting set up. And so you can understand that the union is not going to run up to the microphone and say, hey, this is what we have and got. And I respect that. Thank you.
I have a question, Dave. I've worked in warehouses, and a lot of the stuff that comes off the Port of Vancouver. And, you know, you talk about the sort of the technological change and the sort of, because one of the things that made me think of in terms of containerization, all these supply chains, the role of the ports, is that the amount of work that must be done as a result of all of these supply chains and technological sort of, forcing of technology and automation on the ports, is that it not just must be more work in terms of more containers and more offloading, but also it must be, I mean, record profits for the ports as everything is coming off the Port of Vancouver. Nothing is being made here. So everything is coming in and out of these ports. So if you could talk about really how the technology sort of changed the work at the port, and sort of that disparity in terms of, you know, the amount of containers being offloaded or the amount of work being done at the port, but how little of those profits are actually being shared by the actual workers.
Good point. When I was vice president of Local 500, the biggest local on the coast here, I had to go downtown one afternoon and meet with the employer. And we were talking about repositioning. Are you still there? Hello? I'm not here.
Yeah, anymore. I'm here. I'm here.
Okay. So we were talking about repositioning. And it's not a matter of repositioning cargo in a container. It's repositioning factories. An old friend of mine is an engineer, born and raised in East Van. He's working out of Toronto for the last 20 years in the auto industry. He spent the last 10 or 15 years repositioning factories, productivity into the States. And if he's not doing that, his productivity down into Mexico. And that productivity was getting too expensive in Mexico, and it was being shipped over to China. So I asked one of the employers, this is 15 years ago, at what point will dismantling a factory in Quebec, and I use Quebec as an example because it's an industrial part of the country, at what point will it be cost prohibitive to build a bigger ship to bring product from China across the ocean into a container and back to Quebec? Are you looking at reassembling a factory you took away from Quebec? And he answered, yes, we have an example of a factory that went from Canada to Mexico back to Quebec. I don't know which one it was, but they were these players, they got a little sensitive computer in each container, and they watched the flow of traffic from productivity in China down the highway, how long it sits on the docks, how long it sits on the ship, how long it takes for a container to come off the Port of Vancouver, how long in the rail yard, how long across Canada until somebody opens that container in Quebec. They're doing time and distance like you couldn't imagine. So you're absolutely right. In the last so many years, they've made huge profits, but now they're not going to the historical promise of allowing dock workers, and there's about 7,500 of them on the West Coast here, for instance, to get retrained, build the robots, shine the robots, tune up the robots, install the robots. We knew the work is changing, but they have signed up many, many years ago when the 10-man gangs were broken down. They promised to take us uptown and train us. And every set of negotiations, they ignore that. And what are we suffering? Inflation, productivity, and now robotics overhanging with all this media focus on who we are. If you look at the records for logs and lumber, we have historical records, the best of the best productivity in containers. We don't have robotic container cranes down on the docks. I drove those for 5 years. We set records in productivity. So what is their reasoning to go to more robotics? Is it to help you in Quebec for a better price? Paddy Crumlin, the head of the ITF, the International Transport Workers Federation, he was at the ILW convention a few weeks ago at the caucus talking about their pending collective agreement. And he states right in the paper that robotics is about displacing workers and upsetting the balance of working people be able to make a living in their own community. And if you look at the longshore situation in Canada, where does this money go? I know longshoremen for 44 years. They go out of town for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. The money is spent here on a car, remodeling, you know, their house, putting their kids into university. If these docks are taken over by robots, that income will disappear in the lower mainland and your warehouse will suffer. And all the other people in the stores and the movie theaters, it's a community. And that money we get from those international shippers. And I tell you, they're big, bad players. And I've seen it witnessed over the years with the people that work on the ships. We've seen it in Australia when they brought in armed guards to break the union down there and take away their jurisdiction. And we saw the machine guns in the 30s on the docks of San Francisco. And we saw people killed here in the 40s leading on to the Ottawa Trek. We're up against some huge, nasty forces in here. And I don't make any apologies for going after some of those cats and shaking out a little bit of the money before they take off to the Bahamas while I'm still paying 33%. It's a, like I said, it's a stacked deck. Only a lot of people making commentary don't hear the full scope of the arguments.
Right. And can I actually ask you about that? Because I think one of the main arguments that you heard during the strike was coming from, it wasn't coming from the international shippers, you know, they weren't being interviewed for the newspapers. It was from the small business community, so-called, or the chambers of commerce and so on. So I was wondering if you could talk about the real and imagined economic impact of the strikes, because there's no denying that the strike is actually extremely effective in shipping, because it's really like a concentrated point of capital, basically. But the way that you're talking about it, it's clear, and I agree with you that it's kind of made to seem like that the people who are hurting is regular people, and the people who are doing the hurting are some kind of like gangsters in the port or whatever. I'm sure that that's like an old image that they like to project onto dock workers. So can you talk about that kind of dynamic and what actually happens during a strike and who's affected?
Good point too. For decades, longshore, and I take great pride in this, we're a rank and file union. We make decisions based on regular monthly meetings, mass meetings of our membership. And during that time, I'm a very effective public speaker at those, and I've spoken at the BC Fed and the Canadian Labour Congress to this point. Yes, people are affected, but we're very aware the docks do not belong to longshore workers in Vancouver. They belong to the farmer in Saskatchewan. They belong to manufacturing in Oshawa. They belong to manufacturing in Quebec. And if fisheries can ship their product across Canada and export it from the eastern shores, so be it. We're a service industry connected to these bigger players. We have a very efficient rail service, we have a very efficient dock service, and we have a very efficient warehousing, and some of it is moved to Calgary, some of it's moved to Prince George's, called it inland ports. So everything runs pretty intense and very efficient. Now, before, if you say had, I don't know, a widget, we'll call it, and you'd have to have a warehouse somewhere. So you have a commitment to a warehouse and 10 people who are moving those widgets around, getting them ready to ship from, say, Calgary to Ontario, to go into the car industry, just as an example. Well, before, you'd have 10,000 widgets in your warehouse. But based on inflation, based on the economy, you might not sell them all. So now you're sitting on the product and you're sitting on that warehousing. Should longshore be responsible for that? So the employer designed this just-on-time service. So in other words, instead of warehousing the product here, you order a part for your car. That goes by instant mail to, say, Japan or China. You need a part, And within 18 days, it lands here. And according to this just-in-time economist that I met 15 years ago, she said they can dial product through to Chicago through Canadian ports within a day, within an hour, and sometimes within minutes if there's not a rail disruption. So it's a very, very tight service. So you're right in that it's disruptive, but it's disruptive for 2 weeks over an 8-year contract. Give me a break. If your company is so shoestring that you can't suffer 3 weeks, don't get COVID and don't go through a divorce. Don't get depressed. Don't be a human being. And man, your business model will be fine. But if it screws up for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and we haven't had a strike in 30 years, seriously, don't blame it on the longshoremen. Look in the mirror, man. I mean, seriously. So there's this huge wave of anxiety. Is it really out in the street? Most people I know support longshore. They're the biggest tippers. They hit all the local cafes and they're saying, hey, get more. Come on back to the pub. Come on back to the cafe. Come on to the car wash. Come on down to Home Depot. Spend your money. So if you're going through some grief, you better learn to handle some grief for 13 days. How about if it was 13 months? But you're right. Economics in the longshore is constricted in that it creates a bottleneck. Whereas if you're public service, you're actually appealing to the public purse to get more money. But if they put the teachers on strike, which the employer will do, they build up a lot of aggravation, but it's not a just on time service unless all the people with kids in school go, you goddamn well better get back there and do some. Somebody complained at the BC Fed once upon a time, I'm not paying any more taxes. And I got up in front of 1,200 union reps. I said, I want to pay another $1,000 a year. They're going, what the hell is Prichet talking about? I said, I want sidewalks. I want swimming pools. I want mental health care workers in all of the schools for the kids. I want daycare. I will pay more out of my wages. But when I do that, I want another 10% off all these high-rolling companies that are escaping with our productivity and going to other countries. So I would suggest that all the small players look to see who your real economic problems are, and it's certainly not a 13-day strike with longshore.
Well, maybe let's talk about the union a little bit. Because you mentioned that the ILW is a rank and file union. I think people have like a sort of concept of what that might be. But maybe the way that you can explain it would be to explain how that might have an impact on how strikes happen, how mobilization happens before and during a strike. Like the life of the rank and file union in a moment like this.
Absolutely. Well, that's another thing I've thoroughly enjoyed. And I'll give you an example. Going back about 20 years or so, my time frames are a little off. Don't quote me on the time frame. We were in a confrontation with the employer, and there was a mediation that was happening. And there's certain provisions under the labor code that you have to abide by. I mean, you know, there's some hard knocks to get a lot of those provisions in the labor code. And if you look at it, I had a lot of it itemized because there's some provisions in the labor code that Canadians benefit from in all the small businesses you were talking about. There's some articles in there that were pushed through by longshore militancy. And people ought to respect that they're enjoying some of those conditions because of that historical, militancy. Repeat that question one more time.
Well, just on the impact of what's the rank and file element during a strike and building a strike.
So knowing all those historical references and the founding president, Harry Bridges, he got into a pickle down in the States and they wanted him to make a decision. And he said, I'm not making decisions. I go back to the ranks, and that's what you saw in this last strike. Ashton, who's the president of LWCAD, and gave some recommendations. And we have had this as a common practice since the 30s. It has to come back to the contract caucus, and they review what the officers have done. And then the officers and the caucus have to be unified or a good majority. Then it goes back to the ranks, and the ranks are our brain trust. And they say yay or nay, and they got to look at their pocketbooks. What's their willingness to fight for one more nickel or one more dime? It's up to them. So when I was referring to 20 years ago, the president of Local 500 got up and said something, but he was doing it because of the legalities of what the officers have to do. I understood that political point. So I got up behind the president, and I'm well respected in the union, have a long history. I said, well, I'll use a fictitious name. What Ron couldn't really say is what I'm going to say. This is a bullshit deal, and we shouldn't be going along with it. Legally, we have to, but will we? And the place went wild. So they went out of there with an attitude. And it was about 3 or 4 years later, when I was the vice president, I went downtown again in a suit, reluctantly, and I was drinking the free martinis on the employer's dime. And I heard three of these arrogant, to quote an old longshore phrase, pieces of shit, mumbling in the corner. And I'll just about quote it. I remembered it well. They said, oh, these longshoremen, they'll go on strike, they'll slow down. But what's a slowdown of a month or two? And then they'll go back to normal. They're not as militant as they think they are. We're really running the show. Well, I snapped and I walked over there. I said, oh, hello, I'm Vice President Longshore. And they took two steps back, looking down their nose at me. Well, what have you got to say? And I says, oh, I just wanted to say hi. And I said, I overheard your conversation about what is normal. And then I got into my Irish tone, and then I dropped down an octave and I said, I'll tell you what, you fuckers. And I called them that. You fuckers will never know what normal is. You're standing over here at a meeting I'm at, and I'm the vice president of the union, and you're talking trash like that. I said, I'll tell you straight up, we've been fucking you for two contracts. And they looked at me, and I said, yeah. I said, you figure you won two contracts ago, but the workers are so pissed off that are eating the shit, the coal dust, the asbestos dust. We didn't like it, and we've worked accordingly. So we've put an extra shift on all of your ships. And they looked. Time and distance and money, it's an extra day in the port. It can be 10 grand plus tugs. I said, we will work hard and set records, but if you don't respect us, you will never know what, normal was. And I walked away, and I don't know whether they were going to faint or they wanted to beat the shit out of me, but they couldn't beat the shit out of me. And I didn't care if they fainted, but that's the nonsense, the disrespect that you're up against. But the rank and file knows this because officers like myself and historically will lay all the cards on the table face up at a regular monthly meeting and right in the middle of negotiations. If it's going sideways and people might go to jail, we'll shut the job down and we'll go up to the P&E and we'll rent a hall and get everybody on board. And if the ranks say we're with you, and if not, we change our tactics. Where a lot of unions can't do that because a lot of them don't have a history of regular meetings. So I don't feel sorry for other unions, but there is a model to engage the ranks. But there's a term called business unionism where a lot of what we used to call grand poobahs, they're popular, they get into power, and they want to make the decisions. That will never happen on the waterfront. And old Harry Bridges, right in our kitchen in the East End here back in the late 50s, early 60s, said, Dave, the working class reserves the right to be wrong. In other words, if you go and use a strategy and it doesn't work and it upsets the apple cart, you learn from that and you go ahead and you plan your next move. But we have to face a fact that the employer is making moves on us all the time. They're relentless. And is it for the good of the country? Is it a good for the economy of Vancouver? Do they really care about the small, businessman? I don't know. I think they could run it more efficiently with respect and honor and give us like an inflation rate and keep the historical promise and train us and keep an efficient port. And we'll set records. Jim Spinoza, today in the Dispatcher newspaper, came through my door. Really qualified ex-president of ILWU. You know what he's quoted in the paper said, I want to let you young people know, he said, I've been retired for you. Work hard. Honor yourself. Work as hard as you can and as efficient as you can. They're still going to come headhunting for you, but work hard so you can stand back and say, we've given you all the productivity we can with this amount of equipment and manning and, you know, so forth. In other words, respect yourself. And a lot of the employers won't recognize that. So they panic and they sent all their bullshit artists on the social media and try and set up a dynamic. So the government, in its lack of wisdom, is going to step in and break covenants in the labor code. And you think, and I remind all my working class friends too, the employer, the government, the boss, the elite, they never gave us the right to strike. We took it because it was a necessity. On our honor, we do that for good reason. You don't say I can. I say I'll do it when I have to. And forget about the jail time and all the threats. Before, they used machine guns on us. They won't do that now. But there's a lot of threats and a lot of BS that is, you know, backed up with some of these headlines that they're trying to peddle. But I am not going to suffer longshore workers being the culprits in upsetting the whole economy.
We might have time for one last question. Moose, do you want to have your last say?
I kind of want to go back to the automation point, because it's something you really are sticking on and sort of in job loss. And we're seeing this with the UAW strike. We're seeing this. It's going to be a really a massive question for the working class in the upcoming years. Even if you're working in an office job, the way AI is going to displace workers. Is the demand, have there been demands similar or thoughts similar to the UAWs? You want to automate? We're going to take the same salary, or we're going to take more of a salary, but we also want a more humane work day as well, and less pressure. You know, in the way that UAW has been demanding the 32-hour work week. Has that been a thought for the port workers, or is it the port workers, we like our jobs, we want to keep doing our jobs, but we want respect and dignity, and we kind of want to be, we're not going to let ourselves be displaced by this robot, by the robots. Also, I want to go back to the robots themselves. What is it that they, because to me, it seems like being a longshoreman is a pretty skilled job. So how did they figure out robots that actually could take, what would the robots actually do? Is it that they would control the software? Is it that they would actually be able to physically handle offloading and unloading containers? What work are they actually threatening on the ports?
Well, 15, 20 years ago, we had delegations going over to Holland, Denmark, and we were looking at automated ports back then. And they had container cranes over there with no drivers in them. They had a driver in the warehouse. I mean, in a office building, you might say, on the docks. Flow through, you have to keep a literal eye on a piece of paper for a container. Well, now you don't have to, because you've got algorithms that get the printout from Japan and China with a number on it and a little sensor in each container telling them where it is at all what time. So that's what you call automated checking, you might say, electronic checking, as opposed to paperwork. We used to have people standing on the ship, but it was back in the 50s and 60s, Longshore signed an agreement called the M&M Agreement, and it clearly stated, I can almost quote it, although we have to upgrade it to longshore persons, but the original reading of that was all the men necessary and no unnecessary men. We used to have 10 men down below, 5 per side. Then they went to a four-man gang. And now a lot of that gang work, because of containerization, ended up going to the warehouses. The docks got overrun with too many containers. So then they started having inland ports. So the automation has never stopped. Longshoremen, as part of historically, said, okay, if we recognize automation because the population is expanding, the desire for goods from around the world is expanding, we can't really get in the way of that. But part of that agreement was, we will get all the training as necessary. And that's in another addendum on the back of every contract that's renewed. It's about a three-quarter of a page. I can't quote it right now, but that was a promise. Now, does that mean we're going to get in? We have capable people down there with degrees and everything, but they make a good living on the docks. We could send people to university. We can send people to trade school. They can run those robots. Like I said, they can polish them, change the oil, install them. There's a way of keeping a credible workforce inside the flow of goods coming across those docks. In an ideal world, they'd probably send drones, if they had them big enough, and fly it right from, say, Japan, right to Saskatoon and avoid shipping. But it's all predicated on how much energy do you have to put in to move a ton of cargo. But we have been suffering automation continually year after year. But you're right. Now, artificial intelligence is speeding up the robotics. I mean, if you look at what is it called, Boston Dynamics online, I look at it once a month, and they got robots doing backflips, jumping up on stage and going down aisles of warehouses, picking up boxes, putting them on shelves. I went out to UBC to look at their archives. Jesus, this is 20 years ago. And they opened up a little door in a little office, and I was looking four stories underground with all these automated racks, and they dial in a number for LW Local 500 because we had put some stuff in the archives, waited 2 minutes, and you could see all this little robotic stuff, and it delivered a bin of archival material right into my hand. It's an ongoing thing in the world. We can't fight it. But we're suggesting as a union, and I haven't looked at what they signed up for, but there must have been some saw to say, look, we're going to give you more training uptown. And if there is training to do, we're going to train longshoremen to train the new people. We've got a 10 or 15 people when I left that would train other people to drive gantries and lift trucks. So we trained people to be trainers, and now they're training the new people. In other words, you won't be standing there on the deck of the ship, but everything that is about cargo flow, we want to be part of that loop. And that's what I think they got into. But I don't know the details. And I went online, ILW Canada, they're not talking about all of that because it's an ongoing. It's been going on since the 30s, the 40s, maybe the 1800s about moving cargo and who's going to be in the middle of all of that. And there's ongoing strategies. It does not end in beginning on one set of negotiations. I don't know whether that's answered you, but there is a lot of things in common that I think other unions have to get together. And maybe there'll be some new addendums to the labor code to recognize, you know, some of these things. Maybe we'll be setting up new trade schools here in Canada. But like I say, the employer would like to put most of us out of work, do it with robotics, but get the products to market. And we're saying, well, if I don't have any money, how am I going to buy all these products? They're actually defeating themselves. If they think they can put the working class out of business, they're not. They might have productivity, but productivity is based on consumption. And so who's going to be able to afford it if you can't afford the rent in the town you live in? So a lot of the products that are coming into this town are not necessities, like food, like water. Well, maybe Irish whiskey and maybe some Italian or some Spanish wine. But other than that, a lot of it is just toys and more computers and more this and that. That's not essential to living. And I think the whole world is coming up against that juggernaut. What is really necessary to keep us, you know, progressing as a human species? And longshore have to appreciate that, too. I mean, in terms of robotics. I mean, what's your plan, man, if you're going to lay everybody off of work? It will deflate the economy of Vancouver, and this market of buying and purchasing and using, it will deflate like crazy. So the employer sometimes doesn't even know what's good for their clientele.
Well, maybe that's a good note to end on. I mean, I feel like we could talk for a while.
Oh, yeah.
But got to call at some point. It is 10 p.m. here where we are.
Oh, yeah.
You got some tired dads on the line.
Oh, but, yeah. I want that in the radio show. We got tired dads here. We're bailing on Dave.
We're bailing.
But thanks so much. I mean, it's been really fun to talk about these really big, wide sort of topics with you and sort of tap you for all of your experience and stories. So thanks again for taking the time with us and working through all our technical difficulties earlier.
Yeah. Well, let's keep in touch over, you know, the weeks, the months, the years, and I'll be referring to our conversation at this labor committee meeting I'm meeting up with on, you know, Sunday. Yeah. You've written up some good questions and you got me going. Now you got to figure out how to stop me.
Well, I'll just press exit then. Thanks so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Have a good evening.
You too.
Okay. Bye bye.
With a time on. Just a shake and only just a cold chill. Don't know what it is, I'm calling it a thrill. Just a lump in my throat, just hot blood. Don't know what it is, I'm calling love. Just a check out of my lane, just a cold chill. Just a lump in my throat, just hot blood.
Thanks again for listening. That was Dave Pritchett here on Labor Radio. Thank you so much to Dave for coming on, talking about labor on the West Coast in the ports. Pleasure to have him with us.
Yeah, part of one of the most militant and democratic unions in Canada, and really, I think, helped learn a lot about the struggles of the port workers. So
absolutely. So on that note, make sure you find us on Facebook. You'll find links to previous episodes, and to if you want to re-listen to this, you can catch the whole thing there, and catch us live.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's just after 6 o'clock, and we're about to delve into the show about theater on the radio. Every Thursday from 6 to 7, we look at dramas, to musicals, to burlesque, to comedy, and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyagaha language, and Munayang in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah. We are live in studio on Thursday, September 21st, 2023. How about that weather? Just a couple days left in the summer season. Fall arrives on Saturday, which I have to say I am not too sad about, because fall means back to kind of the cultural life. I mean, we have lots of theater and things to do in the summertime, but it makes me think of being cozy in live theater spaces, maybe going to a film festival or two. So we have a lot of content to talk about for things that you can do coming up in the next couple of weeks, but it is a really nice day out. It's currently